Well, hi. My name is Lisa Friedman. I'm the deputy editor of Climate Wire. And this topic that we're at today, as evidenced by the Knight Journalism magazine out on the tables outside, is a pretty hot topic on national security and climate change. It's also a really hard topic to localize, which I think is evidenced by, you know, kind of a sparse gathering here today, but hopefully one of the things we can talk about is how journalists can make this very international story a local one. I'm positively honored to be on the same panel as these three distinguished speakers. Dennis Dimick, to my right, is one of the three executive editors of National Geographic and has written extensively about the issues of threats that vulnerable countries face due to climate change. Jeffrey DeVelco, at the far end, is the director of the Environmental Change and Security Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. You have his bios in all of the bios in the packet, so I'll just hit some of the highlights here. He's held positions with the Council on Foreign Relations, and he's written extensively on climate change and security. Most recently, a fantastic piece in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, cautioning against some of the oversimplification of the climate change security issue. And anyone who's lived or worked in D.C. knows that the Wilson Center puts on some of the smartest panel discussions in town. Vice Admiral Dennis McGinn has more than 35 years of service with the U.S. Navy. He currently serves on the advisory board of the Center for Naval Analysis. And for those of you unfamiliar with CNA, in 2007, CNA really broke ground with a report in which it retired military leaders, explored the threats that climate change could pose to national security. The most recent report, which came out earlier this year, Admiral McGinn played a central role in developing. He's testified several times before Congress on the threats of both climate change and energy demands. And the three of them, better than anyone, can lay out the landscape for you of the threats and consequences and recommendations of what could and what needs to be done. And I think between the four of us, we can look at some new ways that you might want to look at this issue, and some new ways that you might want to think about covering this issue. I'll tell you just a brief bit about myself, and then I'll let each of the speakers talk to us for a few minutes, 10 minutes or so, about hitting the highlights, and then we can open it up to questions. Like I said, I'm the deputy editor of Climate Wire. We are part of E&E News, which is the leading energy and environment policy journal in the country. Our publication launched about a year and 9 months ago under John Fialca, who was a 20-year veteran of the Wall Street Journal covering energy issues. And our publication started because there was a real hunger for climate policy news. It's what we call niche journalism, but our niche is, you know, really as wide as the Grand Canyon. We have 10 reporters covering everything from science and technology to the international policy issues to finance. And one of the things that is really unique and I think fantastic about this particular publication is that they're really committed to actual journalism that doesn't necessarily just bring in the high-paying subscriptions. Last year, we went to Bangladesh to explore this issue of climate migration, which is really integral to the larger topic of climate security. And at the time, there was very little information about climate migration. I mean, it was just there had been some articles and some studies, but it was really pretty sparse. And I came at this issue from a real interest in immigration. I mean, I had covered immigration for the LA Daily News in California. And I studied immigration issues in college. And I remember talking to experts and saying, you know, I don't know that I understand why this is such a big issue, this thing that I'm hearing, this climate migration. I mean, people move. We move. You know, mankind, since the beginning of time, since early man left East Africa, this is what we do. We move to find fresh water, and we move because of earthquakes and floods, and we move because we get new jobs and fall in love. And what is this? And consistently what I was told was that this is different, that what climate change means and what climate change will bring is more people than ever before in a shorter period of time who cannot sustain their way of life where they currently are. And unlike current migration patterns in which there is a push-pull of, you know, people moving because they have to and moving because they want to, that more of the people on the move will be poor and vulnerable and have to move rather than seek to move because of opportunity. But what I also found as I dug deeper was that this really wasn't the easy story that a lot of groups had kind of made it out to be. And we wound up choosing Bangladesh because it wasn't an easy story to tell. You know, when you look at the Maldives or Tuvalu, not that it's maybe easy is a bad word to use, but it's much more direct. I mean, climate change causes rising sea levels, countries will sink, people have to leave. That's a pretty straight line. When you look at a country like Bangladesh, and Bangladesh is emblematic of the complicated stories that we'll be needing to tell in the future about Africa, about Vietnam, about Central America, and elsewhere, we found that climate change intersects with all kinds of other forces, natural and social, with urbanization and globalization and poverty and overpopulation and bad infrastructure. And we also found that the research continues to be really thin in a lot of places. The numbers on how many people we might see moving are all over the board. The early studies we learned of how many people were expected to have to leave countries were, as I understand it, pretty much done with that climate modelers looked at rising sea levels, figured in GDP in a way that can't explain easily, and X'd a lot of people off the map. And so what we're starting to find is this issue that climate experts have been looking at, now migration experts are also taking a good look at it, now demographers are also taking a good look at it, and there's starting to be a much fuller understanding of how and why people move and what patterns they might follow. I think most interesting to me was that while international migration gets most of the press, you know, the fence between India and Bangladesh, the potential for water wars, so much of the migration that we saw in Bangladesh is internal. People moving from villages to cities. And, you know, as one expert told me that, you know, one Bengali adaptation expert said, you know, prevention's not sexy, but this is what we need to talk about here, is building embankments and aiding very deep poverty. So that's just to kind of set the tone of a big range of issues. I'm going to turn it over first to Admiral McGinn and then to the other Dennis and Jeffrey, and they can take it on from there. Thank you, Admiral.
Thank you, Lisa, and good afternoon, everybody. I'm here as part of the CNA Military Advisory Board, who, as Lisa pointed out, produced two reports over the past couple of years. The first called Climate Change and the Threat to National Security in 2007, and then more recently, in May of this year, a follow-on study that was titled Powering America's Defense, the risks to national security. You might ask why a bunch of retired admirals and generals, near a dozen of us from all of the services, 3 and 4 stars, came together and basically our decades of service in various uniforms told us that you've got to really think ahead. You've got to deal with uncertainty. This was best captured by the chairman of the first military advisory board, Gordon Sullivan, who was the former chief of staff of the United States Army. And he said, we never have 100% certainty. If you wait for 100% certainty on the battlefield, something bad is going to happen. So we have to deal with indicators, warnings, and trends. We wanted in the military advisory board to try to remain somewhat separate from the big discussion, sometimes theological proportions of arguments going back and forth about was climate change real, and if it was real, how was it going to manifest itself, precisely when. We said, hey, look, let's just take a look at the broad trends, indicators, and warnings. And to us, after several years of study, the trends, indicators, and warnings were quite clear. Something was happening that was significant that had a tremendous amount of implications for national security in somewhat of a non-traditional way. Climate change isn't a defined enemy. It isn't a crisis area. It doesn't have a timeline of urgency for response with various aspects of military power. But nevertheless, it is a very, very consequential national security threat, diplomatically, militarily, and economically. We found in a first report that, and I'll try to capture this in a phrase, that climate change will act as a threat multiplier for instability in some of the most vulnerable regions of the world. And the way I think about this is, if you look around the globe right now, there are going to be a lot of fault lines. Many of them have existed for literally millennia. And they run across ethnic, religious, political, and economic lines. And the effects of climate change are like taking that big magnifying glass and putting it on these fault lines and making them more intense, making them larger, and in the case of climate change, making them more frequent. One of the tough things in dealing with climate change is that it manifests itself in a lot of different ways. In some areas of the world, it will be too much water in the form of torrential monsoons or rainy seasons in the United States, North America, as well as around the world. In other areas, it's going to be not enough water, multi-year severe droughts that don't cause one season's worth of crop failure, but rather prolonged drought leading to starvation. In other areas, it's going to affect water, the world's best water storage areas called glaciers. U.S. Geological Survey released a report last month that basically said study of glaciers in North America, including Alaska, there would have been a tremendous degradation in the amount of water content in the over the last 50 years, all precisely measured. So what is a threat multiplier for instability? It is the causes of denial of basic needs for humans that lead to the types of migrations that Lisa just mentioned. Bangladesh is a good example. And it wouldn't necessarily in Bangladesh simply be rising sea level, certainly that. But even a few degrees rise in the sea temperature in the Indian Ocean and in the Western Pacific Ocean could cause a greatly increased intensity and frequency of major typhoons in the Bay of Bengal, as it did in 1991. A lot of people will recall that right after the first Gulf War, there was a huge American amphibious force, Navy and Marines, coming back to their bases in Okinawa and in the United States. They were diverted because of a huge humanitarian assistance disaster relief operation that came to be called Sea Angel, because to the Bangladeshis, this influx of American aid, food, water, medical assistance, logistics, shelter, were like angels from the sea. We stayed there for many, many months, providing basic human needs. And if you fast forward to here, 2009, almost 20 years later, the population has increased, the population density, the reliance of the folks in Bangladesh on those coastal tributaries for their supply of food, coastal fisheries. So you can really imagine a future scenario in which literally millions of Bangladeshis, which, oh, by the way, Bangladesh used to be called East Pakistan, Muslim country, head northwest towards India, towards this wall that is being erected, simply in search of the basics of human life. Not a great scenario, and one certainly, just from a humanitarian assistance disaster relief perspective, would cause us great concern and great pause. The other part of South Asia, and I'm just using these as a couple of examples, but they exist literally all around the world, including in South and Central America, in Mexico and the Caribbean, right here in this hemisphere. Another one would be the Himalayan glaciers. They supply a reasonably reliable source of water and as a buffer for rainy season water to China, India, and Pakistan. In the case of the South Asian countries of Pakistan and India, the Indus River flows through India, and then it flows through Pakistan. It is a major source of agricultural irrigation water in Pakistan. If there's significant Himalayan glacier retreat along the Hindu Kush, you're going to find that there are going to be floods in the springtime of the rainy season, and these major rivers, potentially the Ganges and Indus, are going to become seasonal rivers in that there will be times when there is no water. Given the agricultural basic human needs for water and in some cases the religious aspects of these rivers, it's a recipe for disaster there. And oh, by the way, a recipe for disaster and rising tensions, that magnifying glass effect over two countries that have nuclear weapons. I'm not drawing a bright line from the effects of climate change to a regional nuclear war, but we, in the military and in long-term national strategic planning, you have to consider everything that is possible and then weigh its probability and the consequences of it actually happening. And these are severe consequences. And I'll end by saying that another aspect of this report in 2007, and one that we really picked up on a lot in 2009, is the fact that climate change, energy posture of the United States, and international security are inextricably linked. And you cannot address solutions to any one of those without considering the others, because there are some solutions that are very, very good if you only consider one or two of them, and they're terrible on the other. In other words, you do harm in one regard trying to do good in another. So this is a very complex, very, very significant set of challenges. Lastly, along with all of the bad news that these daunting challenges constitute, we found that this is a tremendous opportunity for the United States and the rest of the world, in that we have the opportunity to apply technology, practices, international and national protocols and policies to really, really convert to a new energy economy with all of the benefits that accrue there. And oh, by the way, as nations, military to military, diplomatic to diplomatic, in trade terms, come to address the options related to prevention, mitigation, and adaptation to climate change, it opens up the door to being able to solve a whole host of other vexing problems, because you start, if you will, with a common enemy. Thank you.
Thank you. Dennis, can you tell us, go next and tell us a little bit about all the things you've
done? Okay. In all honesty, I should be sitting where you are and not sitting here, but last week I sent Jeff DeBelko an email asking him if you wanted to have a beer last night, and the next thing I knew is I found out I'm up here. So I'll do my best. I actually became interested in this thing. I think it was specifically, it was several years ago, Peter Schwartz wrote a study for the Department of Defense. It was called the National Security Implications of Sudden Climate Change. And what that meant in terms of dislocation and what would happen if, for example, we started to see massive droughts and sudden crop failures in places like Mexico. And so I saw the Admiral's report when it came out 2 years ago and followed the one this year. I think these kinds of issues are sort of like, I mean, just from a journalist's point of view, they're underlying all the things that we're thinking about when we're trying to figure out how to do stories. And so I will, I mean, it's I think my sort of angle on this is very similar to Andy Revkin's. I'm just going to run through a few data points and then get down to the implications. This morning, Science Express, online study from UCLA saying they took some ice sheets apart, and they determined that the last time CO2 was this high was 15 million years ago. Temperatures were 5 to 10 degrees Fahrenheit higher than now. Seas were 75 to 125 feet higher than they are now. So now we talk about population trends. When I was born, it was 2.5 billion and 51. We're at 6.7. By the latter half of 2011, we'll be 7 billion on the way, depending upon fertility and whether or not we can get fertility under control by mid-century, anywhere from 9 to 9.4 billion. That's out of the Population Reference Bureau's latest data sheet. CO2 levels keep rising. If you look at the population curve going up, so do sea levels. There's a correlation between population and CO2. In 1950, when Charles David Keeling started measuring at Mauna Loa, we were about 315 parts per million. We're at 387 now. If you add in the impacts from methane and NOx and such, we're at about 450 equivalent. 60% of the oil that we burn in this country is imported. 50% of the electricity is from coal. We're very vulnerable on the transportation fuel front. That's a national security question. In 2007, I attended a presentation on the Hill by Jim Anderson and Daniel Schrag of Harvard, and they were talking about what the implications of rising CO2 meant and also the need for future energy. And Anderson said, look, we're going to need to meet basic energy demands of that growing population. We're going to need to triple our basic energy supply by mid-century. And he equated that out to the equivalent of building 250 nuclear power plants a year for 40 years. Or 1,000 coal-fired power plants a year for 40 years. 1,000 coal-fired power plants a year for 40 years is about 3 a day. And we have been for years at this conference talking about the accumulating environmental damage from our dependence on coal. 80% of our power now comes from coal, oil, and gas, our basic energy supply. A quarter of us on the planet do not have access to electricity. So on one hand, we're trying to sort of rein in our appetites in the first in the developed world, yet a quarter of us have access to little or nothing of what we're trying to sort of go on a diet on. So we're in this double-edged vice of aspiration and also trying to cut back on carbon emissions. So then from that, though, in terms of public understanding, I think this is one of the key issues, and it's like it's just as a citizen as an observer, it's sort of I cringe when I listen to the ongoing debates about, you know, cap and trade and all the exclusions for everybody. I think there's a very low understanding in the public mind of how CO2 works in the atmosphere. We talk about stabilizing emissions or cutting emissions a little bit, but we have to also, it's like half the problem, it's like what Andy wrote last year was it's like it's too bad that CO2 doesn't have a face or it's not of a color and we can't look at it. It's really hard to sort of like wrap yourself around something you can't see, and what you're trying to do is talk about the absence of it being good. And so John Sturman at MIT actually has come up with this idea about the carbon bathtub, and we'll publish a piece next month on this. It's this whole idea, if once you understand how CO2 works in the atmosphere, you will then begin to understand why it's so important to get rid of it as fast as you can. And it's this idea that you're dealing in stocks and flows. Dana Meadows, who wrote about systems, explained this. It's essentially that Currently, the amount of water going into our carbon bathtub is greater than the amount of carbon or water that the natural systems, the biosphere, the oceans, all the trees and the land and the plants are taking out of the tub. And so consequently, that tub, the level in the reservoir just keeps going up and up and up. And the only way we're ever going to stabilize it is, one, to cut the amount of carbon emissions to a level equal to or less than what the biosphere is taking out. Well, we're a far piece from that. So then as an extension of that, then I go to what Susan Solomon wrote in the National Academies earlier this year about how we're committed to at least 1,000 years of continuing warming, droughts, crop failures. It's a very compelling study. She was one of the lead authors of the fourth assessment of the IPCC. And then there was the study in Science in January that David Battisti and Roz Naylor did. It was called Historical Warnings of Future Food Insecurity with Unprecedented Seasonal Heat. Basically, what they were saying was that what you do is you take a look to mid-century and you start looking at the impacts that half the world's population is going to suffer because of rising temperature and heat waves and drought. You're looking at about 3 billion people in the subtropics and the tropics who are going to be subject to essentially crop failures because of, one, loss of water, and then because they depend upon, they don't have money for irrigation, they're dealing with rain-fed agriculture, they live on $2 a day. You're talking about the potential for massive human dislocation, which comes down to this matter of human migration. And so then you come down and then you start looking to say, like the United States, and you get to this question of what did the fourth assessment say? It said basically the takeaway from that in the fourth was that the wet areas are getting wetter and the dry areas are getting drier. And if you just take case studies like in the United States, in 93, major floods on the Mississippi, 2008, major floods in Iowa, and that wasn't even a cyclone. That was just a storm. And then this year on the Red River in the Dakotas, all three of those were said to have been 1-in-500-year flood events. One scientist at St. Louis University said it seems like we're hearing about these once-in-500-year flood events every 7 or 8 years now. And then you start looking at places like the Murray Darling in Australia, which is we did a story on it earlier this year, and it's like it's seen as, if you're looking at an example of a chronic shift in the behavior of climate in a Western industrialized nation, it's the Murray Darling, which produces half of Australia's agricultural income. They're having to live now with a chronic shift in water availability. And the reason we did the story wasn't necessarily that, you know, the 20 million tons of rice that Australia used to be able to grow and put on the world market is no longer there. It was because the Western United States is going down the same path. And if you look at Tim Barnett and Scripps did a study that came out earlier this year just talking about projected declines and future runoff in the Colorado Basin. And you've got, 60 million people living west of the 100th meridian in the United States, and 30 million of them are in California. We're talking about long-term declines in water availability. Those are security questions that as this country is going to have to be dealing with. And it was like earlier this year, Pat Mulroy, who is head of the South Nevada Water District in Las Vegas, she was at a presentation at Brookings. And, you know, I read the transcript, and the session was about how to use infrastructure money to improve water delivery systems and canals. And she says, you guys are missing the point. The point is, it won't matter if we have canals if we don't have water to put in them. And that's where the real concern is. So then it's all just tied into the water, is tied into food, and if you're losing the water and the food, then you're in that position of watching essentially a slow disintegration of sort of the systems that nations have and need for their own legitimacy. And if you can't care for yourself and you don't have the rainfall and you don't have the food to produce, then that's where you get this sort of John Robb writes about this a lot at his blog Global Gorillas. You get a slow sort of insidious decline in legitimacy, and that then you may have a nation but you don't have anything left within it, and that's where you start seeing this sort of emergent of the need to go somewhere else, because the systems that you need are no longer viable? And to end, I think it's a really interesting question that we have to confront internationally, because the term climate refugee or environmental refugee does not have legal standing in the international community. It's like if you're an internally displaced person and you have had to leave your home because of war or conflict, the international organizations have methods and standards for identifying you and caring for you. But this whole question of, like, if you're a climate refugee or, like, your country ran out of water and you can't grow your food anymore and you got to go someplace else, there are no standards that exist currently for the international organizations and the world as a whole to begin to deal with them. So we're sort of in this place where the world, the planet, is beginning to move faster than our ability to respond. And I'll end.
Thank you. And before I turn it right over to Jeff, I just point out that this story, I think it's a great story in the fight over what people who are or may be displaced by climate change should be called. It's a legal fight, but words matter, and I think there's a good story in there on this kind of tiff between the phrase environmental or climate refugee and climate migrant or displaced person from climate change, or some of the other phrases that have been used. Jeff, over to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Lisa. I felt this morning a little bit like I had a flashback. It had nothing to do with the beer with Dennis last night, but it was hearing Al Gore talk about, make that link as he did in one point of his remarks about the connection between fossil fuel dependence, climate change, and security as a kind of fundamental challenges of climate, economic, and security challenge. I got into this field myself and was intrigued by these questions when it was then Senator Gore in the late 80s working with the Navy to release ice pack thickness data that the submarines had gathered in the Arctic to try to provide data to climate change scientists to better understand the system, of finding some practical ways that the military could work with and the intelligence community could work with climate scientists. And so one of the myriad ways these things are connected, and I think I'll try to stress that there are lots and lots of different ways, but also to make the point that while we're seeing lots of attention, lots more attention to climate change now, and thanks in part to the CNA and the work that Admiral McGinn and his colleagues have done, a lot more attention. I don't usually have a problem with projecting. So, a lot more attention to the climate security link. At the same time, we need to remember this isn't new. It was a lot of attention around environment security links tied to the end of the Cold War, where it was perceived we had the luxury and the obligation to understand how this broader set of global issues connected to our broader foreign policy and security policy. So in part, as you are contextualizing your story, there is a history there that you may choose to include or not, but important to know that these are links that we've been grappling with and struggling with in earnest for at least 20 years, and of course there are lots of ways you can tell the story that goes back farther than that. I think there are a lot, as I alluded to with this one anecdote about ice pack thickness data in the Navy, it's important to say up front in tackling this, I guess it's a luxury from the perspective of a journalist, because there are lots of different ways that you could slice it, lots of different ways, lots of different lenses to look at climate security links. There's obviously, from a security standpoint, there's the narrow military use of force protection of homeland versus a broader notion of security that's around human well-being that gets you into agriculture, economics, and health and such. Those are both ways that these things are being linked, and so how to plug into that is something that you will want to decide as you're formulating your stories on it. Certainly, if we're sitting here in the United States, there's a whole range of challenges it poses for us as we look at our own country and then as we look overseas in terms of the postures and the engagements that we have, both civilian and military. And it looks very different if you're sitting in up north in the Arctic and what this means for the Arctic, if you're sitting in the Horn of Africa, and we'll talk about that, place matters. And these links are playing out very differently empirically on the ground, but also from the political and social perspective of the different communities we're talking about. We'll see as we, especially those of you following the debates in Washington around the congressional legislation, you've seen this climate security issue being used as part of a political argument. In fact, on the advocate side, it was said, well, this polls well, so we're going to insert it into the political debate. That's one side of it. There are also, and I would hasten to remind all of us, that there are, as we have heard from our previous speakers, very real, complex, and tremendously important links on the ground. So there's substance. It's not just a slogan. There's lots of substance and lots of links, some of which we understand, some of which we know that we don't but need to. And then, obviously, a wide set of players plugging in. So this gives you lots of opportunities, but it also makes it an additionally complex topic. So I came up with 7 suggestions for how and what to cover on the climate and security story that has a couple of cautions and also has hopefully a couple neglected stories that may pique your interest, and depending on kind of where you sit and what beats you have may be something that you can plug into. I think I'll start where Admiral McGinn did and really second the notion of framing the climate and security link, where climate is playing this role as a threat multiplier. It's a term that comes out of the security community. It's one that the CNA work has really affiliated and associated with this. I follow the UN discussions on this, the European discussions on this, and they all cite this framing of it. And I think it's quite useful in the sense that it is not creating a whole new category of newly discovered conflict, for example. It's that this problem makes the ones that we're familiar with worse. So it makes the water, the agriculture, the food, the kind of range of things that we've heard about, makes them worse. And where those play into social, political, and economic stability questions, that's where it's magnifying this. And South Asia, I think, is a good place to focus. If we think we're trying to deal with political instability in some of those countries, and we are treating environment and setting it aside, or climate change and setting aside, as a luxury item that you worry about once you get stable and once you get rich, then we're going to repeat history and over, because it's not addressing some of the underlying, unfortunately, additional stresses and challenges that we face in addressing those problems. The glacial melt, I think, is an excellent one where we're going to be lulled into thinking things are better because there's going to be more water, and then it's going to fall off. And so if we're talking about Southeast Asia or Central Asia, all sorts of places where that's a really important dynamic. I think switching from that notion of cause of conflict to also, well, then the typical institutions that we look to, or one of them we look to in the security realm to respond, has big implications for roles and missions and procurement from the U.S. military. So they're asking through a variety of processes, well, if we're going to be expected to do more humanitarian missions, what does that mean for what kinds of equipment we buy, what kind of training we do? If we're going to be asked to go up and play a greater role in the Arctic because there is less ice there, that's a big change. And so those are things and reasons why, on the one hand, I think it's quite easy, and Admiral McGinn and his colleagues have sent in multiple forms, military is not asking to take over the climate portfolio, but they are trying to anticipate what ends up in their lap in terms of effects that they have to deal with. So it helps understand why they are paying attention to it. And so we can say, on the one hand, it makes sense for them to be paying attention on it, but no one, I think, or at least no one I think that's coming from a well-reasoned standpoint is suggesting that these security institutions take over the role and become responsible for doing it. Second point that's quite connected, beware particularly your headline writers and your editors who want to turn this into climate causes war. And Admiral McGinn kind of took pains to say he wasn't drawing a direct line between these. I can't tell you how unconstructive it is for it to be framed in such a deterministic, simplistic fashion. It's, as I mentioned, not a unique type of war, but it's going to it makes, in a sense, point to me one war that had a single cause. I mean, we're holding it up to a standard that is not one that we hold any others. And furthermore, where it can be quite counterproductive, you had some, whether he was rightly or wrongly interpreted as saying that Sudan was the first climate war, the Secretary General created quite a kerfluffle that, among other things, gave the regime in Khartoum the ability to say, hey, we're not doing it in Darfur, climate change made us do it. Because it's this kind of inevitable deterministic. There are lots of reasons why climate change, but all the deforestation, desertification, water resources are part of that story, but they are not the only part or the deterministic part of that story. So that it's a plea for complexity, which I know is not always easy in terms of space and such to do, but one that is critically important. The migration, I think we've heard from all our speakers on migration, point number three. Really big challenge, very appropriate focus, very vexing. Again, a plea for precision. I would say, Lisa, that we need to do two things. One, really avoid using refugees because, as we've seen in many instances, it's also subnational. And so by definition, we're leaving out that internally displaced group. It doesn't have the legal status. And you're right to point to the importance of trying to sort that out. But unfortunately, I think those who are advocating for trying to do that do themselves a disservice by using these terms that make it seem as if they're not aware of the international legal frame. Furthermore, be very suspicious of anyone who is promising you a number of climate migrants or climate. We don't know. And in fact, I would say it's almost impossible to know by the very notion that people move for multiple reasons. There are pushes and there are pulls. There are pushes of environmental displacement. There are pulls of economic lure. So if you're making a decision to move out of a place where it's difficult to earn a living, whether that's due to climate change or any other reason, are you being pushed out or are you being pulled by economic opportunity across the border to the next community? So in that sense, we oversimplify in ways that I think are going to make it more and more difficult to come up with effective responses. And it continues to be a real challenge because I agree it's absolutely one of the biggest dynamics that are going to have security, economic, political implications from this. Number four, this is in that category of what I would call neglected, but also neglected because it's still evolving story and we don't know how it's going to play out, which is, what conflicts will we create by trying to address climate change? So if we can assume for a moment that we actually get serious in some fashions to address climate change, we're talking about big changes in terms of money on the table or land use change or behavioral change. How, if and will it create conflict? I would suggest a couple areas where we could see that this perhaps has happened or could happen. Certainly, the whole grow your energy biofuels question, it was a complex mix of energy prices and access and perception versus reality and market availability. But you had food riots associated with that and food shortages associated with that a couple years ago, particularly in developing countries. Is that something that we're going to see going up? Nuclear power, there's a call in some quarters for more nuclear power, the question of increased access and loose nukes, as well as the challenges of disposal. If we get serious, and we're trying to get serious on alternative energy, transportation, the importance of batteries, lithium is a critical input. Well, lithium is just as, if not more, concentrated in terms of its location than petroleum. Places like Bolivia and Chile. So are we setting ourselves up for the same resource curse dynamics that we have in countries that have governance challenges, we'll say, in with this other critical input, as well as it being a foreign dependence, leading us to get ahead of ourselves, perhaps, with a couple blog posts on blood batteries and such as a playoff from blood diamonds. And then finally, those of you following RED, the reduced emissions from deforestation and forest degradation. Talking about a lot of money on the table and changing land use patterns and land use access, and you better believe that that's going to be contentious. Doesn't have to be end of the gun, but lots of issues around corruption, participation, governance, who owns that money, and who's told what they can't do with forest resources. And at least I'll speed up, I promise. Number five, after talking about all that conflict, I would be remiss if I didn't say, let's remember to try to turn it on its head and look for environment and peace or environment and confidence building avenues, as the Admiral alluded to in this realm. It's something we've worked on a lot at the Wilson Center, environmental peace building and peacemaking. If a few of you may remember, or all of you may remember, we had this incident not too many months ago with the Chinese ship and the U.S. military listening ship off the coast and such. And one of the upshots of that was President Obama said, our military and the Chinese military need to find ways to talk with one another on a lot of different things. There needs to be more interaction. And so a retired colonel and I wrote an op-ed saying, why not climate change? Why not adaptation? It's both in terms of both militaries have capacities around natural disaster preparedness. Why not use that as an avenue that's less contentious to find a way to talk and build confidence? So it can be useful in that. And then I think, finally, recognizing vulnerabilities at home. I've heard a lot about Bangladesh, and I think for all the reasons that have been enumerated, clearly the poster country for high levels of vulnerability that bring it into a security realm. And I think that kind of, at least for me, has traditionally meant that if you went low to high on vulnerability, developing countries like Bangladesh were high, and developed countries, because we had resources to deal with the problems, were the low. I would suggest that as we look, as Dennis suggested that we do, at vulnerability of the United States and places that are actually quite wealthy, that it's actually an inverted U in terms of the vulnerability to climate change within the security context. So if you have lots of built environment on the coast, if we're all used to flipping the sink in the kitchen and getting clean water immediately, that expectation there is actually part of what, if we're denied that and it doesn't turn on, that we're actually quite vulnerable ourselves. And so the extreme of Bangladesh on the one hand, and developed countries with lots of infrastructure, lots of money, but we saw Katrina can really test our capacities. And we need to think, particularly if we're looking at how we assess climate and security links in the United States, that needs to be seen as a U-shaped curve rather than a linear line. So I'll make the same plea that Al Gore did this morning, that we see climate change in this larger, the climate change story in this larger context of a story of the economic, the political, and the security as well. So thank you very much, Lisa.
Thank you. Thank all of you. I think I'll take the moderator's prerogative and ask you all a question. But before I do, I'm curious from the audience, how many people here are local reporters, local television or newspaper, or just a handful? Oh. Well, then this is for you. Before, as we go on and ask questions, I'd like the three of you to kind of keep in the back of your head that this is an issue that, I mean, by its nature, it's a national, it's an international issue. When local newspapers write about it, it's usually, you know, a clip from AP, and readers get, you know, climate wars. as we're talking throughout the rest of this panel, I'd like each of you to try and think of one way to localize this story. I mean, if you're a reporter in Bakersfield, California, if you're a reporter in, you know, in Miami, if you're a reporter in Missouri, how can you help make this, how can you take a piece of this story? I'm not going to make you all answer that now, because I feel like I've hit you with something out of the blue, but chew on that. And in the meantime, let me ask you, Jeff, you mentioned that this is getting a lot of political play right now. The issue of national security is front and center as the Senate starts to debate their climate bill. I'd like to get your take. Both of you have been on the Hill a lot. Admiral, you've testified before Congress. How much traction does this issue of national security have? And when it comes down to it, for those members, mostly Republican, who may have national security concerns but also have a lot of cost concerns and others, where do you think interests will ultimately fall? I mean, when it comes down to it, are people on the fence more worried about national security or more worried about economics?
They're worried about both, and I think there are some that will never be convinced in a reasonable period of time that we need to do anything with climate change. I've gone around the country a lot. In fact, I was in Alaska earlier this week, California last week, Indiana, South Carolina, Missouri, Virginia, Florida. And I've had this conversation with a lot of folks, and everybody gets it pretty much about the energy security thing and dependence on foreign oil. That's usually the little iconic discussion that takes place. But this business of climate change and is it really real and how does it affect me is really, really ripe for some really good journalism. Making climate change and the effects of climate change come home. Not in a, there was that movie that had, you know, ice all over the Statue of Liberty and Manhattan and all that kind of stuff. Okay, great, sure, that's science fiction. Could it happen? Sure, but that's not going to grab people's attention. In fact, it's a turnoff to the elected officials, the Senate, is where the debate's going on. But things that make sense, and as Jeff said, one of the things that is really, really powerful is this idea of take a look around the world where we got problems and then add more stressors to those problem areas, and that becomes real, becomes a real national security problem. One of the things that I and my colleagues on the military advisory board at CNA worry about is that we don't want to have people who have been fighting for environmental legislation for many, many years for all of the right reasons say, oh, this is great. You know, we can add a little spice to our argument called national security, the national security argument, and maybe co-opt a few of those fence sitters. What we're saying very, very clearly and directly is this is a national security problem. Energy security, climate change, national security, inextricably linked. We've got to come up with comprehensive solutions that address all of them. And if other folks want to take their portion of it and, you know, try to use the national security argument, okay, that's fine. But this is, make no mistake, a problem that will affect everybody in the world and, of course, in the United States. If you think that there was a great debate about how long we should have been or should be in Iraq or Afghanistan, those two wars affect a lot of wonderful people in uniform, their families, friends. But the thing about the threat of climate change and energy insecurity, that affects everyone. And if you say, well, we're going to be there for 20 years, that is a very, very short period of time compared to the time frame that we're going to be dealing with the effects of climate change and energy insecurity. This is a big story. It's a big national security threat, and we need to characterize it that way.
Yeah, I have 2 points I want to talk about potentially for you in terms of trying to localize it. And we're working on a big water project for next year, so I'm going to give you a couple of examples from that may be useful for you. There's a guy in the Netherlands. His name is Arjen Hoekstra, H-O-E-K-S-T-R-A, and he has done a book called The Globalization of Water, and it's this whole idea of embedded water, virtual water. And the idea when you start looking at a global food marketplace where grain is moving around, if you're involved in any, say, for example, if you're in the Midwest or if you're in the grain-growing regions or any of that, it's useful to try to understand that a lot of these countries that are water short are already importing grain because they don't have the water to grow it. And so that may have an impact, say, on in your local circulation area or where you live, it may have an impact. That may have an impact on, say, on grain prices. Last year, for example, is a case in point, after the Arab oil embargo of 73, Saudi Arabia decided they were going to become self-sufficient in wheat. So they did, and they were, and they grew wheat. And how they did that was that they mined the fossil water from the aquifer, the non-rechargeable aquifer under their ground. Well, they have come to the realization that aquifer's going dry. And so now they're scaling back on their wheat because they don't have the water anymore. That means they, like China, are going to the global grain market. All those sorts of looking around and seeing what other countries are doing as far as being able to grow their own grain is because they have water or not, is going to have a big impact on, say, for example, what happens in agriculture right here in the United States. And one other thing I think is the linkage between water and energy. If you look at something like 48% of the fresh water withdrawals in the United States are for the purpose of cooling thermal power plants. That means that that water comes out and is used and is returned to the streams that they're in, but it also has an impact on temperature. It's not polluted, but if you are, for example, in a situation like in the Southeast, where a couple of years ago they had a severe drought, they didn't have enough water in the streams to keep the nuke plants going. So, I mean, when you start looking at these sorts of Jeff will talk about them as being knock-on effects. Those are the kinds of things that you can think about. And also Peter Glick at Pacific Institute, if you're not familiar with him, please be familiar with him. He's one of the great thinkers on water, and he talks about that. For example, I think in the state of California, half the electricity is used in the state just to move water around.
I will just second Admiral's remarks to your second question, Lisa, and add one more in terms of making it local, ways to make it local, which is the fact that in many communities around the country there are going to be military bases, and to suggest that there are going to be, and already are in many places, interesting things going on around energy use and technology and in some cases, managing lands that could and are talked about for use in terms of solar and just providing the space for solar arrays, getting off-grid and distributed energy. And so this notion of targeted R&D and the technology and the spin-offs, and we can talk about the efficiency of that versus public investment or private investment. But nevertheless, for some security-based reasons, that's going to happen. And we might as well find ways and tell those stories of how it's happening and find ways that it can make jumps into civilian and broader access. So the fact that so many of our service members are susceptible to these improvised explosive devices when they're driving fuel across land is a pretty strong incentive to have more fuel-efficient vehicles and or different fueled by different types of power sources, energy sources. And so those are things that, you know, that military security operational rationale ought to be something that we try to find ways to take advantage of to meet these larger challenges, because we don't have the luxury of ignoring that sort of advance that may be motivated by entirely different set of reasons, but things that we should find ways to take advantage of in the civilian, on the civilian side as well.
I'll make a quick interjection on Jeff's point. One of the folks on the Military Advisory Board in our deliberations a while back said, "America, we gave you the Hummer when oil was cheap. Now we're taking it back."
Yeah, we're selling it to the Chinese, aren't
yeah.
we?
Yeah.
Questions from the floor? Yeah.
Yeah.
Could you also identify yourself?
I'm Bill Curran from the National Academy of Sciences.
Thank you.
I've got a couple of photos that I've used in various presentations, one from September 2005 where the Arctic ice sheet is connected to North America, and then another taken 2 years ago in September of 2007 in which you can actually see a clear line, dark blue line, if you will, where the Northwest Passage is actually open and we're able to sail boats through there. When I was in Alaska earlier this week, a lot of discussion about the opportunities as well as the challenges up there. I think one thing we've got to do, and this is a unpaid political announcement, we have got to ratify the Law of the Sea Treaty. I mean, it is so good for the United States and our international partners to do that. We've got to get our Senate to get on with it. Let's ratify it. It makes sense because of things like the Arctic and having some rules of the game, if you will, in which we can manage this global resource. And clearly from a military perspective, especially for the United States Coast Guard, we're going to have more of an infrastructure and more ships probably up there, icebreaker type things. How many people are going to have to die of acute appendicitis on a cruise ship transiting the Northwest Passage before there's a hue and cry about getting ability to get Coast Guard rescue helicopters out there. I mean, it sounds like a little bit of a trivial scenario, but there will be occasions that we're going to need to have more presence up there. One last point. One of the things that I've encountered in various blogs that are in opposition to this idea of a military embracing climate change as a challenge or accepting it, there's this cynicism that somehow we as retired guys are promoting the military-industrial complex and we're looking for more mission, we're looking for more money. The Soviet Union quit. We got into Iran. North Korea is acting a little bit better. So we're looking for another threat. That is categorically wrong. And we're just saying we need to recognize that threats come in all different shapes and sizes. This one is big, and it is ugly, and it is real. And we as a nation, not just the military, military is really a small part of it, but all of the United States of America and every citizen in it has to take this seriously and do some things about it. And the things that we can do about it now equal opportunity. The things that we do about it every year that goes by, the options get more narrow and they get much more expensive.
In the front first.
We have not, no.
Is that something that you think should be looked at?
I think it's probably more appropriate for other groups to take a look at that. It certainly is an issue. But I think that what we would be looking for is a more granular understanding of the migration patterns mentioned by Dennis and Jeff both and Lisa as well. Michael Oppenheimer is one of the members of the IPCC, works out of Princeton, and I was talking to him a couple of weeks ago in Washington, and he and some of his colleagues at Princeton are trying to do some very, very good analysis on exactly where they think, more precisely where they think migration is going to be the greatest threats. That will be very helpful to long-range national defense planning and military planning to have some sense of where the real bad spots could be.
So you feel that overall is the issue of climate-caused human migrations is more centrally in the focus of your...
It is. That's it in a nutshell, because fragile governments will become failed governments. Into that vacuum of governance and power will rush people with extreme ideas. We've got examples, not climate-caused or climate change-caused, but Afghanistan, the problem with Taliban and al-Qaeda. We're seeing it before our eyes in Somalia and other places in the Horn of Africa. And, failed states are not good things, and they do pose a significant threat regionally as well as globally in some cases.
On the left.
I cut one off for time, but that was my technology one there at the end. Sorry about that. Yep.
Was to look for opportunities to explore areas for cooperation and confidence building. I wonder if you give us some other examples. One I wonder just in some ways, you see this as grueling and challenging as it is. The Copenhagen UNFCCC process is one gigantic exercise in confidence building internationally. If that's a success, that will be a remarkable.
Sure. I would grant that the fact that we have as vigorous an engagement in that process, which we could suggest that a year and a half ago it wasn't as serious, may be a sign of greater possibilities for cooperation, because we're now willing to play on a variety of areas. And Law of the Sea would be a great one to demonstrate that. The fact that we have now said that we will engage on the Mercury negotiations and such, there's the real prospect for that. There is quite a bit of work on this, using, capitalizing on interdependencies around environment to try to build trust, cooperation, and peace building, in the sense that you have to cooperate over the long term to manage these resources, or because you have mutual interdependence around them. They tend to be more focused locally than the climate issue presents as framed by climate, although climate makes water cooperation in the Middle East all that much more important. And that's one place where we've seen examples where it's not going to solve the conflict, but dialogue around jointly managing water provides a lifeline for dialogue when things are bad in the other aspects of the relationship. So Jordan and Israel, at a picnic table, had the picnic table talks to jointly manage their water throughout multiple decades of war before the peace agreement was signed, in part because they had to, but it also built some personal relationships and some bridges that were then useful in the peace agreement itself. You can find examples in South America where using the kind of transboundary peace park mentality between Peru and Ecuador, you had a long simmering border dispute that was that codified an ecological zone approach, or as the unit, by having respective environmental management built into the peace agreement itself. So you have the kind of the peace parks realm. You have a lot around water, both locally in the Middle East. You have Friends of the Earth Middle East that's doing it community to community, school to school. But then they use those alliances of mayors to lobby at the national and even the international level and testify on the Hill and such. And then you have the transboundary, which has been the Nile Basin Initiative, which has been the kind of classic case for the water wars are coming, when in fact all those countries are sitting down at ministerial levels to make a transition from asserting rights to water to really evaluating what their needs are to try to find ways to share benefits. And part of that is pulling the political boundaries off and trying to see what a quote rational use of that water would be, and then putting it back and figuring out how they can trade some of those benefits across boundaries. So we can talk about it more. I think climate's a little harder because of that scale, but finding things such as, in some ways it's because climate change in the field is not the issue between the U.S. and the Chinese Navy, that it's a safer spot to have interactions. We did this coming out of the Cold War with joint Norwegian, Russian, and American assessments of radioactive contamination in the far north. We just wanted to talk to Russian officers because we didn't know them, and we wanted to establish links and figure out what was going on. This, it was an important topic, but really it was finding ways to talk across lines of tension. So I'll stop. Unfortunately, I do a lot of work, so I get started and I don't stop talking.
And in fact, if I could just go back for a moment to the previous question, because I was piqued, Admiral, by the study that you mentioned at Princeton that's happening now. Jeff, you've written about one of the things you mentioned in your Bulletin of Atomic Scientists articles, if I'm not mistaken, is this to not let the debate get ahead of the research. And so I'm curious, from the three of you, what is the state of research right now on climate migration, on conflict born out of climate change? How good is it? And what are the real holes? What are the big things that we don't know and that are being studied and that need to be studied better?
I don't think enough is known, certainly. I think we're starting to, we've got notional ideas, and I think it was Jeff's point that one of the ways of making climate change and international security real is to look at the as-is crisis spots in the world and just imagine how they would be with this added stressor of climate change, whether it manifests itself in the form of inundation with water, whether it's sea level rise or typhoons or hurricanes, or whether it's it's multi-year droughts and crop failures or disease vectors, et cetera. Much more needs to be done, and it needs to be done in a very granular way. You may have read or written about the fact that the CIA just established in their Science and Technology Directorate a study center for climate change. The Department of Defense is taking a very, very hard look, mandated by Congress last year in the Defense Authorization Act, of what are the effects on roles, missions, and installations, Jeff mentioned this earlier, of climate change and energy security. And I think these and other sources of study, they'll rely on the university community and the NGO communities to try to get a much better understanding at a much more refined level about what the effects are going to be, not just on the weather or climate, but on the people in it.
I think one good example for us all to be aware of is actually if you wade into the thousands of pages of the IPCC Fourth Assessment 2007, the Working Group 2 on Impacts, Vulnerability, and Adaptation is perhaps the most interesting if you're trying to figure out, so what does it mean for me or my part of the world in terms of water quality, food, habitat disruption, all that. There's chapters on virtually every section of the planet that they're essentially, they aggregated all the peer-reviewed research they could put together for all the regions. And that's actually a really good place to start if you're looking for some baseline knowledge on, say, for example, how vulnerable is the region you're interested in to understand. Then it gives you a place to start looking when you start seeing certain things happen, whether droughts or floods.
I guess I would just add to that to say that the state of the research is that we know that there are really big problems, but at the same time we know that we really have a long way to go, particularly for the fine grain. What does it mean in specific settings? So on the connections with conflict, I think we have a little bit of quantitative work and a lot of case study work that talks about connections between different natural resource types and both abundance of some and scarcity of others and connections to conflict. Now climate change comes on top of that, exacerbating those water scarcities or those land availability and such. And so bringing those together is an additional task, at the same time bringing it down. So we're just now getting, for example, both geo-referenced environmental data and matching it with geo-referenced conflict data at a subnational level, because so much of the conflict, overwhelming amount of conflict, is within states, not between states. So you really have to get it down to that fine grain to really be able to understand that. Similarly, on the migration, I think we're finding that some of the notions of all the stereotype of it all being transboundary south to north migration is not actually where most of it, if the past is a predictor, and that's always a question, that it's going to be internal and south to south. Still tremendously important with all sorts of implications, but that's what we have a long way to go to really have lots and lots of confidence. We know enough to know that we got to pay attention to it and study it more.
You had a question, yeah.
Basically, as I understand it, are there any examples of geopolitical situations, tensions, if you will, over things that are essentially climate? Is that the best example I can think, and it may be an imperfect one, is what happened in Darfur. As you know, was mentioned earlier today, the crisis in and of itself wasn't climate driven solely by climate change. But shifting water patterns, the failure of grazing lands in the northern part of the country caused migration of herders down in the southern farming areas, and that was a catalyst for reigniting old tensions. And there were, you know, political and social and religious, in some cases, overtones to that, and economic as well. So that is one example that I would use. A less perfect one probably is Somalia. The changing climate and rain patterns there, too much rain, not enough in some areas, certainly has been a threat multiplier for that fragile country, and it's now a broken government, if you will.
On the back in the middle? No, you...
I would say water's a big one. It's probably if you had to make a priority list, water would be right up there at the top. But think about what happened several summers ago in Europe, in France, the heat wave. And that's a significant thing. That was a very sophisticated, modern country, good communications, transportation infrastructure, medical facilities, and a lot of people died just because it was so hot for such a long period of time. And if you get that kind of heat in areas that are not used to it at all, that's going to be a major development that's going to have tremendous security impacts. Many of them will be internal, but some could be external as well. And I'd echo what Dennis said earlier about the southeast. I'm not as familiar with the problem with the nuclear power plant cooling down there and that recent drought, but I am in France. That same summer, water levels got so low that they did have to shut down some of their nuclear power plants because of the river levels. And you can see there's a potential for a cascading effect. What do you want when there's a major heat wave in an area like that? You want air conditioning. Well, air conditioning requires more electricity, and yet there's less potentially electricity because of water levels. So you can have these compounding effects even in a local sense.
Jamie, hi, how are you? They are implicitly related to water, but not directly. I think I'm from Oregon, so I'm acutely aware of what's going on in the forests of Western North America, and there's this it gets back to what Emily was asking about changes in ecological systems, and what we're seeing is changes in the breeding patterns of pine bark beetles in the West, because cool, wet summers have become warm, dry summers, and it's doubling the breeding capacity of the bugs in the trees, and we're seeing vast swaths of trees being killed across the West. We haven't seen the fire explosions as a result, but what we're seeing is essentially the setting up for a transition in the plant communities when the fires do come. And I read one article last year that said 80% of the lodgepole pine in British Columbia are going to be dead in 5 years because of this. And you're seeing it's all through the Cascades, and it's going through Wyoming and Colorado now. So it's like the fire hasn't happened, but all of the sort of the tinder is there. And there's another really interesting phenomenon that UC Boulder reported on earlier this year, and I saw it in situ, and it was shocking. It's this whole idea of multiple years of drought in the Southwest is causing an increase in large dust storms. And those dust storms are blowing up, and it's like the San Juans in Southwest Colorado got no fewer than like a dozen large dust storms. It's almost like watching layers of sediment in ice cores this spring. And what happens is that then this dust lands on the snow and it changes the albedo of it and speeds up the melting. And so what was happening in the Southwest was that actually the peak flow of in stream flow runoff in the spring was advancing a full month this spring because the snow was dark and was melting earlier. And that has an impact then on that it's all sort of on the timing of water availability for like when if plants are sprouting in the spring because of temperature and day length and the snow is already gone, then the water's not there to do its work at the time the plants are ready to take it. So those are just two other kind, not flood and drought, but there are other sort of, there's all these sorts of little in-between things that we're seeing.
Thank you. I realize that we went over, so we need. I mean, we can't. Do we have time for? There's a bunch of hands up. Do we have time for one more question? Or do we need to? Okay. We'll take one last question, and I'm sure that our speakers will probably be milling over here for a few minutes if folks want to ask them questions afterwards. There was someone in the ma'am in the. Thorny issue. How do we address some of these issues in difficult parts of the world?
I can do a quick one. Thank you, Leslie, for the question. I think one of the groups that are trying to do it is, and perhaps given the politics, may be the useful conduit, which is the UN Environment Program's Post-Conflict and Disaster Management Branch is starting to do some work in conjunction with the Paul Mill side of the UN, the Department of Peacekeeping, DPKO, Peacekeeping Operations, to try to start very tenuously to get towards some of that. I do think there are some, I think you're right that finding way, if part of the case is we need to address environment and climate in the context of poverty and livelihood so that it is not left and made more attractive for recruitment into radicalization or fundamental movements, then one has to engage and address those. I think it may make sense for it to be a multinational or multilateral as opposed to certain bilaterals or a state, you know, part of it would be staging. We've seen some instances on this environmental peace building where you get the IOs or the NGOs to do it first and then bring the bilaterals in later. So perhaps
it's
Admiral?
It's a tough problem. I remember back in 1992, we went into Somalia as part of a United Nations, led a United Nations force called Provide Hope. And one of the things that became quickly evident was many of the relief supplies that were being brought in by people from around the world, donor nations from around the world, were literally being used as weapons, if you will, for control. So it's a tough, complex issue. I think probably Treasury and that policy, and I'm not familiar with all of the intricacies of it, but I suspect that it probably has to do with erring on the side of caution more than anything else. But I think your point is a valid one, and we need to, working through the United Nations, see what we can do to try to get help to the people that really need it without being in reality or perception supporting terrorist or extremist groups.
A big thank you to all three of you. Very much. Thanks.